you are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Arman Rana.
And I'm Ben Nelson. It's Thursday, September 19th at 5:04 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
That's right. And on today's show, we have a lot of great content for you. We did some streeters with UBC students. Most of them are around 20, people in their 20s, late teens, to get their perspective on what the top issues are in the federal election. And Ben, you did an interview with who was the individual?
A local high school activist named Malka Martz Oberlander.
Right. So she talks about the impact teenagers who are not yet old enough to vote could have on the coming election. But before that, we are going to start out with a piece done by myself and Armand with reporting help from Joshua Azizi on the updated TRPP and how and if it is being enforced by the city. Just a bit of context, the TRPP is the Tenant Relocation and Protection Policy. It was first passed by the City of Vancouver in December 2015 and updated this June of 2019. So the story digs into whether, in fact, this policy is protecting renters and in what ways it is, and how that affects local redevelopments and rezonings, and in particular one that came up last week. So let's take a listen to that right now.
Okay, thanks very much, everyone, for coming here this evening to this public hearing. I'll now call the public hearing to order. And clerk, can we have the roll call, please?
On Tuesday, September 10th, great. City Council heard from the public on a rezoning application for two apartment buildings in Marple.
And now we're moving on to number 8, which is the rezoning at 8656 Oak Street. Clerk will now, there we go, can read the application.
This is an application by W.T. Leung Architects Incorporated to rezone...
The rezoning application was requested with the intent to replace two rental buildings with a total of 43 units, with a taller six-story building with 91 units of housing. The project, as you probably already know, passed the next day. It was a close vote, though. It was 5-4. With councillors Swanson, Hardwick, Fry, and Boyle voting against. Despite the developer giving 30% off of the asking price to existing tenants, as the Georgia Strait reports, even with that discount, a one-bedroom will cost $1,313, which is an additional $545 to what it currently costs to rent a one-bedroom. So why did this project pass? Well, there are a few reasons. We're not going to get into them all, but one is that it will create more rental stock, going from 43 units to 91. And another is that the city passed updates to the TRPP, or Tenant Relocation and Protection Policy, this past June, which means that renters have more protections. And with these new updates, low-income renters have added protections. Kennedy Stewart has said this updated TRPP is Canada's broadest and most comprehensive series of protections for renters. It was pretty clear on September 10th during this public hearing that Councillor Carr was taking these updates very seriously. Take a listen to her speaking with a low-income tenant about just how helpful the TRPP will be in helping to find another affordable home.
Thanks so much, Ms. Bananal. In terms of, you said that you would love to have a place that is, you know, very close to within 10% of what you're currently paying. The under the new tenant relocation plan, the landlord's required to find a place for low income, and you called yourself low income tenants, that is would be at a rent that is 30% of their income. So if you earn $30,000, for example, at low income, that would be a rent of $750 a month. Required to do that under the plan. So are you aware of that?
No. So what Councillor Carr is referring to is that under the updated TRPP, low-income tenants, which means individuals who make 30,000 or less per year and families who make 50,000 or less. For those tenants, the applicant must assist in securing an affordable housing option. Not only that, for all tenants, so not just low income, the applicant must provide three options that best meet the tenant's identified priorities, and all options should be in Vancouver unless otherwise agreed upon with the tenant. My News Collective colleague Joshua Azizi asked Councillor Christine Boyle about these TRPP updates just one day after this vote took place on September 12th. Let's take a listen.
I wanted to talk a bit about the details of the updated TRPP as well. So according to the June update, a developer that displaces tenants is required to provide three new housing options that best meet the tenant's identified priorities. So for example, if a tenant says my priorities are to get to work within 30 minutes of leaving their house, then I have to find a place that is dog friendly, that my place has a balcony. For a developer to find a tenant a place with all of these priorities, is that even possible? To find all these priorities in an expensive city like Vancouver?
I hear pretty mixed reviews on how possible that is. If the tenants are low income enough, then they could be offered a spot through the BC Housing wait list. So that wait list is long, and there are people and families on it who have been waiting years and years on the wait list. I hear anecdotally that some people are able to find a place through relocation specialists. I hear from others they just got emailed a few Craigslist listings. But of course, there's 50 people at an open house for any new rental unit, so it doesn't actually secure them the place. So I'm interested to hear how that requirement is actually playing out and being implemented on the ground. I don't have clear numbers, but my sense is people are having trouble, we're not able to enforce it as much as would be good for renters.
And this is what seems to be key, enforcement. How do we know those who apply for a rezoning or redevelopment permit will actually find affordable housing for low-income tenants or for any tenants? And how do we know applicants will be able to find housing for tenants that meets their various needs? Is the TRPP legally enforced, or are we just crossing our fingers and hoping that developers do what they say they will? Myself and my colleague Armand Reyna spoke with Andrea Gilman, who is a senior planner with affordable housing at the City of Vancouver Today, to see if she could clear some of this up for us.
Hi, Alex.
Hi. Yeah.
Hey.
Great. I'm just joined in studio by my colleague Armand Reyna.
Hi.
Hi there.
There. Thanks for taking time to chat with us. I'm just adjusting the levels here. How's your day going?
Pretty good. Thanks for asking.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. I think we've got things set up. So we're just recording here.
Okay.
I'll get Armand to take things away.
Okay, awesome. So thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Could you tell our listeners a bit more about who you are?
Sure. I am a senior housing planner with the City of Vancouver in our affordable housing projects group. And I've been with the city about 10 years, and I've been working in the housing sector for about 15 years now.
Amazing. Thanks. So we wanted to talk about the TRPP. So the TRPP, or Tenant Relocation and Protection Policy, was adopted by the City of Vancouver in 2015 and updated this past June. Can you explain briefly what the policy does?
Yeah, thanks. So this policy, as you said, has just been updated within the last few months. It's essentially designed to provide enhanced support to tenants who may be impacted by relocation, and the policy aims to reduce the impact of that. It does that in a few ways, and give you some examples. The updates to the policy that were brought in basically double the compensation requirements for displaced tenants, provide greater assistance in finding permanent housing really to those most in need. So there's a focus on low-income tenants, on seniors, on persons with disability, for example. And then it provides requires increased communication between the landlord and the tenant throughout the process, and it also provides for increased oversight by staff
half of that process. So tenant meetings, notices, things like that. And then kind of a bigger piece that was brought in as well at the same time is just a new approach to our social housing providers, where they are also, where social housing tenants are facing displacement. So that really focuses in on permanent rehousing options and maintaining the affordability for those tenants.
I see. So in terms of the TRPP, do development or rezoning applicants in Vancouver have to sign on to the TRPP, or are they all obligated to follow its guidelines?
They would have to. Essentially, all development permit applications or rezoning applications would have to go through a tenant relocation plan, or create a tenant relocation plan in cases where there is displacement. And so it's going to apply to two different types. One is a primary rental stock, so that's what we would call the purpose-built market rental housing. So a three-story walk-up, for example, I'm sure a lot of students are familiar with, a lot of people are familiar with, rental housing units that are above commercial spaces, so along Broadway, along some of the major streets, and then multiple conversions with five or more units. So those are sort of the common houses that are broken up into multiple suites. That's the primary rental stock. It would apply there. And then the newer piece that was brought in through the update to the policy is application to secondary rental stock. So that's going to be things like rented houses, secondary suites, basement suites, laneway houses, and that's specific to cases where a developer is building back something with five or more units, and also where there's a consolidation or of two or more separate lots.
So basically you're saying it applies to almost all rental?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So last week, there was a rezoning that went before council, which narrowly passed, and this was the rezoning at 8636 8656 Oak Street.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching part of the public hearing and heard Councillor Carr ask a couple low-income tenants, they described themselves as being low-income, if they understood the updated TRPP. And under the updated TRPP, the rezoning applicant was obligated to help them find new housing.
Right.
So under the TRPP, it states that the applicant would have to help tenants find three options that best meet their priorities. And it was just added that for low-income tenants, the applicant must assist the tenant in securing an affordable housing option. And first of all, I just want to clarify, is affordable defined as rent within 30% of a person's income?
I guess how it's done in these cases is there's this where there are tenants who are being relocated, there is a survey that's put out to all tenants by the applicant, where they would then have to kind of declare a few things if they consider themselves to be low income, and then we have definitions for both a single household for singles, couples, et cetera, and those with a family, and income maximums that correspond to that, and also give an indication of the budget that they're looking to spend on housing.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So from what I read in the updated TRPP, low income for a single person is making 30 grand a year. And for a household, it's 50?
Yes, for with families, yeah.
Okay, so if a single low income person makes 30 grand, that means the applicant would have to provide housing for them, which would cost around $750 a month.
I haven't done the math, but potentially, yeah, I don't have those numbers in front of me.
Right. So, I mean, that's roughly accurate. So do apartments that cheap exist in Vancouver?
Yeah, I would say that this is it's a challenging policy to implement in some cases where we have the tenants that you've described.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say we work with the applicant to kind of follow through the process from the time we get the draft tenant relocation plan all the way through to implementation, to work with them to kind of come up with options to assist the tenants as best they can.
Right. It does seem like a challenging situation. Additionally, the applicant is supposed to find options that include, like, the tenant's priorities. So a person might have a dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they need a place that's dog-friendly.
Pet-friendly, yep.
Or they might have a wheelchair, so they might need somewhere on the ground floor that's accessible so they can get in. So it just seems to find affordable rental with these priorities in mind in a city as expensive as Vancouver seems very challenging. So I guess my question is, how is the TRPP enforced?
houses and forests. So I guess a couple different things. We're working with the province on a few different initiatives to enhance compliance through the Residential Tenancy Act, just generally. But as far as the conditions of the tenant relocation plan, we sort of have checks in place throughout the process that align with our permitting process, where we're looking for various reports to check in with the applicants and see where they're at, see how many tenants have been rehoused, and the final step of which is a report that's due at occupancy, so it would coincide with them being issued their occupancy permit, which sort of summarizes where they've gotten to. But certainly our staff are, we would have a housing planner assigned to the individual files, and that's an open line of communication for the applicant and for the tenants to talk through any complexities for their individual situation.
So we interviewed Councillor Christine Boyle last week, and she said she heard mixed reviews on the relocation assistance under the updated TRPP.
Mm-hmm.
She said some people are just sent Craigslist ads by the property developer. Others are put at the end of the waiting list. So are the developers in any way forced to comply with, or provide a certain standard of assistance? Or, like, I'm just wondering what are your thoughts on people's experiences who just get like a Craigslist ad?
I mean, I always think about it as a realistic option. So if somebody's given a Craigslist ad and they call that number, you know, a couple hours later, and that ad expired 2 days ago, or the unit was mm-hmm. taken within 5 minutes, I don't see it as a realistic option. So where we have, you know, we do encourage applicants if they haven't done this before, or even if they have, to hire a tenant relocation specialist that can help them walk through the process and assist them in finding options. And, you know, we're more than happy to work with those specialists as well to review the options, or if tenants have concerns, we are happy to chat with the tenants and, you know, are doing. So it is a new policy. I mean, it's not a new policy, but it is an update to the policy. So we're just a couple months in, but we will continue to monitor how it's working, and work with with council to seek to make updates should we need to.
Okay, I just have just a couple quick questions, then we'll let you go. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a tenant relocation specialist. Is that provided by the city, or is it paid for by the applicant?
It would be paid for by the applicant.
Okay.
Yeah, and we have seen that, you know, particularly in larger buildings or inexperienced landlords, where they may want to seek assistance from an individual who can work directly with the tenants to generate options for the tenants, particularly where there are maybe lower income tenants or higher needs tenants that, you know, the examples you've given with the pets, if somebody needs an accessible unit, things like that.
Right. Okay. And so, as you said, you know, this was just updated in June, so we're just working through things at the moment. But I'm just wondering, do you have a sense now of, say, you do find in reports that an applicant has failed to assist tenants adequately in finding new housing? Like, would there be legal repercussions, or what would the consequences be?
Currently, the reporting requirements are tied to issuance of permits, so
okay.
we would want to receive those reports and make sure that we are happy with those reports when they're due.
So basically, the applicant could lose the right to get another permit to rezone or redevelop?
It would be tied to the individual for that specific application. I don't know what the implications would be on future applications.
Okay.
Separate applications.
Right. I guess just like it's just interesting because, you know, watching Councillor Carr at the public hearing last week speak mm-hmm. with low-income tenants who were very concerned that they would not find somewhere affordable to live.
Absolutely.
And her basically saying the reason she's voting for this, one of the reasons, was because she believes that or that under the updated TRPP, it says that low-income tenants are now being offered affordable housing options by the developer. So if that's not actually being enforced, then it kind of undermines her vote and perhaps others.
Yeah, no, certainly, as I say, these are these various check-in points
you know, prior to rezoning, after public hearing, before the issuance of the development permit, and all the way through to occupancy, there are check-ins that are tied to the issuance of those permits, where staff would be reviewing the final tenant relocation plan to make sure it's adequate. And again, if there's a relocation specialist, or if we're in communication with individual tenants or applicants, we would be talking with them all the way through to ensure compliance.
So just to follow up on that, does the tenant have to like sign or acknowledge that they have been successfully relocated as part of this process?
The communication happens earlier with the tenant, where we are looking for a notarized declaration from the applicants that they have communicated the terms of the relocation out to the tenants. But certainly through our renters, newly set up renters office, or through the individual housing planner, we are in regular contact with tenants.
Okay, great. So I guess, will you be issuing a sort of overview report of how successful this has been, like, in a year's time, or is there any timeline for an assessment of the updated TRPP and how it's working?
I don't have those dates at this stage, but I imagine we will be. As I say, we are currently monitoring the plans that are in implementation now, and okay. We'll look to report back in the future. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Andrea.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Armand. Bye. Take care.
Hello, and you are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for tuning in. So you just heard a piece we did on the updated TRPP and how it is interacting with renters in the city. So we're going to go to a short break, and then we're going to hear some streeters from the UBC campus on how young students, what young students are thinking about the federal election, what issues are important to them, and we have another interview after that. So stay tuned. We will be right back with more local news.
What are you doing on Sunday, September 29th? Come down to the Vancouver Convention Center East Building to check out the Study and Go Abroad Fair. It's free, and it's a great opportunity to find out how you can boost your resume by studying abroad, working abroad, or learning a language. Come early at 12 noon to catch our feature seminar on scholarships. For more information, check online at www.studyandgoabroad.com.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
Crackdown is coming to CITR. Starting August 30th, CITR will be airing the award-winning podcast about Vancouver's overdose crisis, told by drug user activists and supported by research. Crackdown is hosted by celebrated documentarian and longtime drug user Garth Mullins. Catch Crackdown every Friday morning at 8 a.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Democracy Watch 101.9 on CITR. So we're going to have a piece now, which was a bunch of street interviews we did with UBC students on their thoughts on the federal election, what issues were important to them. The streeters were conducted by myself, Alex DeBoer, and Isa.
Yeah, we're not sure of their last name, but they're a new member of the News Collective, and they were awesome. So the three of us went out, and we talked to a few people. This isn't all the interviews because we did not have time to edit them all, but it's just a sample, yeah, if you will.
A selection.
Let us take a listen. We are walking around outside of the Nest. It is very busy. It is Clubs Day.
Do you guys have any idea who you're going to vote for? Like, what issues matter to you?
Well, she's American.
Oh, can you vote here? Are you dual?
I am dual, but I haven't registered to vote.
Do you think you will?
Yeah, eventually, for sure. Haven't gotten there yet. But eventually.
How about you?
I'm definitely voting. I'm from Ontario.
Cool.
So I'll like vote back in my like riding. And I haven't actually registered to vote. I have to do that. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a crapshoot. Like, I really don't like Andrew Scheer, and I am tempted to vote strategically, which is like not a great thing to feel like you have to do. And I definitely like totally align more with like the goals of the Green Party and the NDP, but like, man, I really don't want that guy to be our next prime minister, and I really don't want to see a conservative government. So yeah, that's kind of the way we're leaning right now.
Do you feel like the choice is between the Liberals and the Conservatives?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, like a little bit, and I see the potential for like a coalition between the NDP and the Liberals, which I think could be a really great thing. It'd be great to see the Green Party gain some ground in this election, establish themselves a bit more. And I think, like, with a younger generation of people voting, like, that's definitely a possibility. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it's all going to shake out.
How old are you?
I'm 19.
You're 19?
Yeah. Okay. This is my first federal election voting, yeah.
Federal election.
Yeah.
And what would you say the number one issue for you?
The number one issue? I don't know. I mean, obviously, like climate change and climate action is a huge thing right now, and it kind of permeates every other issue. Like, you can't really kind of segregate all the different issues. I'm also like a student studying health and public health, so healthcare reform, pharmacare, those are huge issues for me as well personally. Yeah.
So stuff that NDP is promising to then.
Especially, yeah, and that's why it's like it can be a bit discouraging to feel like you're a little stuck voting for one party, and they're definitely part of the platform for the NDP that I would definitely agree more with. But yeah, I don't know if that's a solid answer. It's kind of all over the place, but yeah.
I think one big thing for me is like environmental issues, kind of bringing more awareness and focus on that sort of things. Other than that, I don't really have any main issues.
I can't, but you can.
Yeah.
I won't be of age.
Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 17.
Right.
We're both 17.
She turns 18
the day before the election.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
And I'm 9 days after.
So. Are you gonna be voting?
I will be. Yeah.
Do you know like specifically what party, like who?
Yeah.
Yeah. What issues are like you prioritizing?
Mostly education, yeah, and agriculture, because we are from kind of a smaller farming town. So for us, that is sort of a bigger deal. Yeah.
Which riding are you voting in?
We're voting in
Sea to Sky.
It's the Sea to Sky, yeah.
So your main issues are agriculture. Like, could you expand on what that means a little bit? Like getting funding for agricultural practices, or like lower taxes, or I don't know.
So mostly just kind of a safe agricultural practice.
Are there any other issues that stand out for you in this election?
Well, the pipeline, obviously, that's an ongoing one that's been a big deal.
What do you think about the pipeline?
I'm Native American, so it's a big deal for me. So if I was voting, I probably would have gone for the NDP, because they're mostly not for that. And they're more, they're more influential than the Green Party, so
yeah. Our town is, it's like 50-50 Caucasian Native American, so the pipeline is a big factor in our riding as a point of discussion.
Mm-hmm. People disagree or they agree?
Generally? Most people disagree. They don't want the pipeline.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, what are your thoughts on the election? Do you know who you're voting for, what your issues are?
American, so I am not very up to date on Canadian politics at all. I'd like to be more, but every time I try, I get confused.
So you can't vote in the election?
I am a citizen, so I can, but I've only lived here for 3 years, and I have no family that's here to like inform me.
So are you gonna vote?
I don't know yet. If I can educate myself for the next few weeks, yes. But otherwise, probably not.
What party are you voting for, if you're willing to tell us?
Oh, yeah. I will be voting for Don Davies for re-election, who is an NDP candidate. Yeah.
What riding is he in?
Oh, God. I forget what we're called. I'm by Joyce Collingwood. Yeah. Yeah.
So what issues do you prioritize when you're looking into, like, who to vote for?
Mostly, I am not wanting Scheer to have any more power than he already has. I would love to have an NDP majority. I think it's unlikely. I'm mostly concerned with bridging the gap between the most wealthy and the most marginalized folks.
Great. So how old are you?
27.
So skill test imposter.
Have you always been voting like NDP?
I vote strategically depending on where my riding is. But if I didn't have to do that, I would always vote NDP.
All right. And we are back. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. So you just heard a sample of Streeters done by myself, Armand, and Isa. We did them on Wednesday?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we did them around UBC's campus. We mostly just tried to speak with folks who look like young students, so didn't target any faculty or older folks. And so what you heard was just a sample, as I said. It wasn't all the interviews, So... I wanted to talk about what stood out to us, but maybe I'll start with your thoughts, Armand. What stood out to you from doing these Streeters?
I think two things. One was the environment seemed to be like the number one issue for a lot of people, or it's sometimes the sole issue they talked about.
Yeah.
Which is not surprising, but just how important it was to so many people was surprising.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that stood out to me was a lot of people were kind of had not really thought deeply about the election yet, mm-hmm. or were not aware of the election, or had kind of interesting positions. I remember one person, I don't know if we played them, they said they wanted to vote strategically, but they didn't like Trudeau. But then when yeah. I spoke to them a bit more, they said they were in an NDP riding, which kind of confused me. So there are a lot yeah. of people have very kind of, I think a lot of them haven't really started really thinking that much about the election. And I think for us is like who report on this, it's like, oh, it's election season.
Yeah.
But I think for a lot of people, it only really starts like a couple of days before the actual voting.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Like, yeah, for us, like I've already learned, like listened to so much coverage of the election. But if you're 19 and you are living on campus and you're studying not political science, or even if you are, this is something you probably don't know a lot about, and definitely we found that. Like when I was 19, like I was saying, I did not know anything about any level of politics, so no judgment. But yeah, I think like as a country, we probably have to do a better job of educating younger people. Yeah, so to keep our listeners in context, like the folks we talked to were between the ages of 17 and 29. Those were the sample size. And most of them were between, like, we're around 19, I would say. So we talked to, I think, three or four people who were in their mid to late 20s. But the rest, the majority were very young. And I would say overwhelmingly of those people, most did not know what was going on. But most said they care about the environment. I'm trying to think about if there was anything else. Yeah, we talked to those two girls. One, both were in the Sea to Sky riding, and in their town, agriculture was a big issue. So the one girl was going to turn 18 the day before the election, and the other girl would still be 17. But they said for them, like, the pipeline was a big issue in agriculture. So, you know, hyper-localized issues to that area, that makes sense. I thought it was interesting that there was a bit of a perception, especially among younger people, I think, of this election being between the liberals and the conservatives. Like, what do you think about that, Armon?
Yeah, so for me, this is my first election. So I'm not really sure how it generally is. Like, I'm aware that in 2015, the NDP was considered a viable party because they were official opposition.
Yes.
And whatnot. So this must be somewhat new. But yeah, I definitely got that impression as well, that people were thinking this was between the liberals and the conservatives, and a lot of them were discounting the NDP or the Greens as having a chance. And as I mentioned earlier, like, oftentimes people weren't necessarily thinking about their writings. They were just making a general statement when, you know, you can make an argument for strategic voting, but you should not be using nationwide polling for that. You should be using data based on your individual writing to make that kind of argument.
Totally. So. And I think that that's so much a reflection of how people really intake a lot of international and national news and not a lot of local news. Like, people don't know who their MPs are. People don't know who their MLAs are. People don't know who their city councilors are. And, like, so they just, yeah, have this broad sense of, like, okay, well, it seems like it's the liberals and conservatives and, well, not necessarily where you live, right? So, yeah, that was interesting. Also, to your point that during the 2015 election, the NDP was the official opposition. That's totally correct. And guess what? The Liberals won, and they were in third place. So, like, this idea also that it's just between the Liberals and Conservatives, not necessarily. Yeah. And, I mean, we're seeing, obviously, with Trudeau and the photos that have emerged, that, you know, things come out of nowhere, and gotcha moments happen, and it can change. So, who knows? Who knows what will happen in this election? Okay, cool. So, on the topic of young people and the environment, our youngest News Collective member, Ben, who is in studio with us now, did an interview with one of his classmates.
One of my classmates, Malka Martz Oberlander. She's been a part of numerous movements around the city, specifically a lot of the climate strikes that have been occurring recently. And then I just talked to her about what's coming up in terms of the climate strike, and just as a general topic, what can kids who aren't old enough to vote do to still impact the election?
Right. So how old is she?
She's 17.
Right. And you guys go to high school together?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And she's been part of the sustainability teams?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, part of the sort of grassroots movement we're seeing in the city and around the world, with very young people advocating for the climate and the urgency at which we must address climate emergency. Okay, cool. Well, let's hear that interview. Here we go.
Could you please tell us who you are and just a bit about yourself and what kind of organizations you've worked with?
Okay. Hi, my name is Malka Martz Oberlander. I have been doing environmental activism since I was quite little, actually, thanks to my sisters. I've worked with organizations like the Dogwood Initiative and a bunch of nonpartisan organizations initiatives to get people to vote. And I've also most recently worked with sustainability teams and all the climate strikes and stuff like that.
The federal election is approaching quickly, and teenagers like us, kids who are in their late teens but not quite 19, are caught in a bit of an awkward spot where we're intelligent enough to vote but not quite old enough. First off, do you think that it is important for teenagers our age to keep up to date on politics?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, us as youth, we've been disenfranchised for a really long time, and we've been left out of the really important decision-making parts, which has led to
part of that has led to what we are in the climate crisis, especially by the Canadian government, who has made reckless decisions about subsidizing and supporting the fossil fuel industry. And these decisions have jeopardized our future. So I think more than ever, it's really important for us to be able to be knowledgeable, get up to date, and
So there's a climate strike coming up, I believe, next Friday. Will you be attending that?
Yes, I will, and I suggest everyone coming. Everyone should come, like, no matter how old you are or if you've ever been to one or if you know anything about the climate emergency or anything, just you should come, and yeah.
Do you think that student involvement in these protests will make older generations take our generation more seriously, especially if students are walking out of school to do this?
Yeah, I think that as this election comes, we are children, like, and youth are really looming over everyone's minds about our future, and we are a big ticket issue. Sounds weird, but we are, and I think that naysayers aside, it really does make a strong impact because school is such an important thing, and adults always want. It's very important for adults to be able to have us in school, so to be able to walk out of school and take that. Decision that we can actually control, something like that, is really big and could make a really big impact.
What would you say to a student who's on the fence about going to these protests?
You can make a difference, and that going to this will make a difference. It will. There's a conversation happening, and you can join it, and this is a way to join it, and that we're all here to support you no matter what your interests are, whether it's theater, whether it's writing, dancing, acting, or public speaking, or press, or whatever. We're here to support you, and we need you for this. We need to stay together and stick together, and so we really need you, yeah.
You've been doing a lot of promotion for the upcoming climate strike on your Instagram. Do you think that the one next Friday will be their most effective strike yet?
I think every strike is the most effective strike yet, and that every strike is different, and every strike will be having growing attention and more people coming and different people coming. And did I answer the question? Yeah.
Besides protests, what else do you think high school students could do to shine light on issues that they think are important or care about?
Just stay up to date, talk to your older family members, talk to your parents, and make sure you know what's happening, because knowledge is a huge tool and knowledge can be very, very powerful. Stay up to date and contact your local local MPs and everybody to be able to demand change, and come to these events.
Do you think our generation's knowledge on how to properly navigate social media gives us an edge on speaking up about issues that we think are important?
Yes and no. I think social media can be a huge tool to be able to get people out there. It can be a huge tool for the good, but it can also be very hard to navigate it. And with misinformation, it's really hard to be able to get the truth, which is why being informed in the first place really helps you, because you know what you're talking about. And then you'll be able to get to the real point. I mean, Facebook events and that all stuff is really helpful, and as everybody knows, but there's a lot of misinformation, so just really stay on top of it.
What do you think it would mean to certain newer voters to know that they have the support of the next generation?
You're exercising your democratic right, and you should be voting, and that it's really important what you're doing, because people like us, youth who are like, I don't know, 13, 16, 18, or 6, 17, who can't vote, you're voting, and that's great, and you're exercising your democratic right, and you're getting, this is going to be actually, this election, I think it's like ages 18 to 24 is like 37% of the voter turnout, and it's going to be a really big one for young people. So it's really important to be able to, for you guys to vote, and we're here backing you in every way we can, which is a lot of ways.
Do you think that these school walkouts and protests will get political figures to rethink how they campaign 4 or 5 years down the line, or maybe even now?
I think it already is, and it already has, and it definitely will. These strikes are showing that we are using our voice as youth who can't vote, to be able to show that there needs to be, we're demanding change in our climate, in our political climate. And absolutely, I think it's telling a lot of politicians and a lot of local politicians that we are not okay with what's happening right now on this route and that we need them to change.
So for anyone who's maybe interested in attending the protest next Friday, could you give some details on it?
So there's going to be speeches, there's going to be some songs as usual, as all the climate strikes, and we're going to actually walk and go marching. And there's a few other events happening before then, up until then. So there's a die-in on Friday, September 20th at 11:30 sharp at the Vancouver Art Gallery. And a die-in is just a really great way to be, it's a great way to protest and show and highlight the cataclysmic and like really dire situation that we're in the climate emergency. And it's going to be really fun, but you have to be there at 11:30 sharp because that's when it's going to start. We're all going to fall to the ground and lie on the ground at the Vancouver Art Gallery. And then there's a Chalk for Change at the Transit Action at Saturday, September 21st, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Creekside Park. I think there's going to be speeches and we're going to have a conversation about organizing. It's going to be a little smaller. And there's an art build Wednesday, September 25th at the Lush Warehouse at 8365 Ontario Street, which we're going to be making signs and stuff like that. And then the big climate strike, of course, on September 27th at the Vancouver Art Gallery at 1 p.m.
Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me and just talk about this stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
We don't have many enemies here at CITR, but we do like to keep our friends close. And when you become a member of CITR, our friends are your friends. So join CITR today to get discounts at Audiopile, Red Cat, Vinyl Records, Hooked on Phono, Rufus Guitar and Drum Shop, Tapestry Music, The Cinematheque, Kerner's Pub, Stormcrow, The Pint, and Fortune Sound Club. For more info, visit CITR.ca/friends.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
and the Sakhuya, Talitin, who must we must fail. From September 26th to October 11th is the Vancouver International Film Festival. VIFF presents the world's best cinema fused with related talks and events in a unique Films Plus model. Annually, VIFF presents over 320 films and events, plays host to approximately 400 industry professionals from around the globe, and boasts the largest Canadian film program in the world. Tickets are on sale now. Go to VIFF.org or the Van City Theatre box office to purchase yours today. Wake up in
June. All right. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm joined by Pranav, Armand, and Ben in studio, and we've been hearing some local news today, and now we're going to switch a little bit to some national news because everyone's talking about it. Justin Trudeau did brown face and black face, and it is everywhere, and yeah. So we're just going to talk a little bit about how we feel about it. Armand and I have talked about this quite a bit today, but it's interesting to just dig into the potential implications and like to assess kind of what's happening on social media, which I've been doing a lot on Twitter, kind of scrolling through. Is that really representative of, you know, Canadians? Like, probably not, obviously. Depends who's on your Twitter feed. It's hard to get a sense exactly of how people are feeling. Like, I was watching The National for a bit last night, and the newscasters made it seem very clear that this was a very dire situation and like a really shocking thing. And then they switched to a reporter in Vancouver who was interviewing folks on the street who were all people of color, I think everyone who was interviewed. And they were all like, yeah, I don't know, people do dumb things. Like, pretty much was the consensus. And I was like, you know, I get so skeptical about, like, it's very hard to tell how the majority of people are feeling based on news reports. So I don't know. What do you guys think about this big scandal that's just come to light?
I think this scandal in general is something that brings to light the amount of failures that this current government has been going through, starting from SNC-Lavalin and going up to the photos that surfaced.
Yeah.
They, according to opposition parties and a lot of other people, they are a general pattern of behavior that deems irresponsibility and that has really hurt, you know, in a big way, the integrity of the Canadian political institutions that exist today. So it is really a concerning thing for a prime minister to be going through this kind of a media scandal right now. And that's just like a month away from the federal election. But saying that, the question that we were discussing, that is it strong enough to break the camel's back?
Yeah.
What kind of an impact will it have on the result of the federal election? Because we know the Liberals aren't the most perfect candidates in this election, but are they better than most other candidates? That is a question we need to ask. And I think even after these failures, the Liberals can come out strong, can come out on top of the game if they acknowledge what is going on within their party and, you know, work towards something concrete that actually redefines their stance
right,
on their failures.
Yeah. Like what you were saying earlier when we were off mic, I mean, or someone was saying, we were all talking, that it's less that it's the Liberals' policies that have been failing, which have overall been pretty popular, and more like this situation and perhaps the Liberals' failure, if it does happen, will be perhaps more to do with Justin Trudeau as a leader than like the party itself. So for him as a leader, what do you folks think are like his particular shortcomings or failures that are gonna perhaps, you know, bite him in the butt this time?
I think another thing that we were discussing earlier was that if there was a regular candidate who was not the son of a previous prime minister, they would have received a proper, you know, vetting and checking.
Yeah, totally.
And I believe this kind of stuff would have come out, but I think there was probably a lapse of that kind of stuff with Justin Trudeau.
Yeah.
During his process of becoming a politician. And now we're seeing the consequences of that. And I think it's a choice Canadians will have to make is that, you know, there is a Trudeau brand and it has some currency and has some value to it. And at the same time, it's getting damaged every day with these kind of gaffes and, inability to navigate different social situations.
Yeah, totally.
Or cultural situations or corruption situations or.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he brought up even in his press release when he apologized for this, like, he's like, oh, you guys know I get a little enthusiastic about costumes, like in reference to when he went to India and dressed up and like he just he does a lot of things. I think you put it well, like he seems to have an inability to adjust to different social and cultural situations in a way that most people find appropriate. So we'll see. Ben, did you have any thoughts you want to share about this particular debacle?
I mean, it was a topic I discussed with one person at high in my school today. And
yeah.
I think just talking to them, they're of the opinion that at this point the election is voting between a lesser of two evils. I don't know if I would personally go as far to say that, but yeah.
Who are the two evils?
Just I think the person I spoke to was normally like very liberal, and obviously like this was just terrible, and this hit them pretty hard. So it would be, I guess, Trudeau's Liberals and the Conservatives.
Right, but they still feel like he's still a bit better than Scheer.
Yeah, because they don't agree with the Conservative policies.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and I mean, Scheer's response to this was pretty funny, too. Like, he outright condemned such acts of racism. You know, it's what Justin did in 2001 was as racist as it is in 2019, which, like, I mean, hopefully nothing he did that was racist comes to light.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, he was probably the most forceful out of all the party leaders in his condemnation of Justin Trudeau's acts. And it seemed a tad opportunistic to me, especially given that the positioning of the Conservative Party has been a lot of, you know, along the lines of, you know, people grow and we cannot be like a PC outrage society and we need to, you know.
Yeah, he said if people apologize, we should be able to forgive them and move on. Yeah. And then this comes up and Justin Trudeau apologizes and
he's unfit for office.
He's unfit for office. He should resign as prime minister.
So it was, you know, kind of, I'm not sure if it'll pay up because I think, you know, Bernie has made a quite a different statement. He believes that
Bernier? Maxime Bernier? Bernier.
Yeah,
I thought you meant like Bernie Sanders. Yeah. I was like, stay in the country.
Yeah, so Bernie, my French is
Bernier. Term.
Bernier, okay.
I'm very fluent.
Maxime Bernier made a statement that he doesn't believe Justin Trudeau is racist and kind of more in that vein. And I think just in terms of positioning and branding, I think that's more in line with what Andrew Scheer has said in the past about these kind of issues.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's leave it there because it is 6:01, and that is when our show wraps up. Thank you to everyone who listened in. I am actually going to put up content on Seeking Office tonight. I've had some major tech issues in the past, even though I said I'd put out content and I didn't. Honestly, it's been crazy here. None of the microphones in our studios are working. So it's a whole thing. I will actually put out the piece on the TRPP on Seeking Office on its feed today. So check that out. And again, thank you for listening. We'll be back again next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more local news coverage. And stay tuned for more CITR. Have a great night.